Welcome to the Lending Forward podcast, brought to you by Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group. This is your home for real discussions about the mortgage and housing industry. Our hosts are here bringing you firsthand accounts from people at the heart of the business. And we're chatting with professionals from all corners of the industry as they help cultivate transparency around the future of the industry we love. Together, we are lending forward all we know to you. Thanks for joining us for today's episode. Let's dive in. Today's episode is sponsored by the Chenoa Fund, a national down payment assistance program, excluding New York, dedicated to expanding affordable home ownership. To date, over 50,000 families have used the Chenoa Fund program to achieve the dream of owning a home. If you're a lender or real estate professional, explore how down payment assistance may help you serve more borrowers and grow your business by visiting the Chenoa Fund program website at chenoafund.org. That's chenoafund.org.
Awesome. Well, we are back with another episode of Lending Forward. I am your host today, Hannah McManus, and I am here with our guest, Lynn Wolfson. Lynn is here to talk all about the Big Beautiful Bill. Lynn brings a deep experience and expertise in federal housing policy, having served in senior roles at HUD and the FHA. Lynn launched Breakaway, a government affairs firm focused on housing policy and advocacy. And Lynn, we are so excited to have you on the podcast. Hey.
I'm excited to be here, Hannah. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, before we dig in, I want to hear a little bit about you. I know I just gave a very short snippet, but I know you've had a heck of a ride. Tell us a little bit about you and your background.
A heck of a ride makes me sound like an old geezer, but I came to D.C. in 1996 to work for my hometown congressman, a moderate Republican from Connecticut named Chris Chase. That's when they're still were moderate Republicans from Connecticut. I did not know how long I would be here in Washington, but here I am almost 30 years later. But I've had great opportunities since leaving Capitol Hill, serving in the last two Republican administrations, George W. Bush and the first Trump administration. In the first Trump administration, I was the Assistant Secretary for Congressional Relations. So led all of the department's efforts on Capitol Hill. Then in 2020, had the real honor of being named by the president to be the acting FHA commissioner. And when I took that role, I did not know that we were about to be hit with a once-in-a-century pandemic. My tenure there was all about responding to the pandemic and making sure that people stayed in their homes and that we didn't have another housing crisis, which I'm pleased to say we were able to avoid.
That's awesome. We are so grateful to have you join us. We, you know, the Big Beautiful Bill's all over everywhere. Everyone's talking about it. And I'm really glad to have you on to talk through a little bit of how it affects housing. So moving it right into that, I mean, what are the most significant, you know, housing related provisions in the Big Beautiful Bill?
Thanks. And, you know, we're all still getting used to calling it that.
It's a long name.
It's a long name. And the way it came about was there was a debate that absolutely consumed all of us wonks in Washington early on. Just a tactical question as to whether the president's agenda should move through Congress as one piece of legislation or two. The House favored one bill, the Senate favored two. And everyone was looking for the president to referee this debate that no one outside of the Beltway could care about. And one day he said that he'd love to see one big, beautiful bill. And we all laughed. And then many months later, it turned we opened the bill and looked at the first page, the title, and it was called the One Big Beautiful Bill. So here we are. But look, to your question, Hannah, This predominantly was not a housing bill, but it did end up having some really important housing provisions that I think are quite meaningful. One of them is the low-income housing tax credit, a pretty significant expansion of LIHTC and making it permanent as well. And LIHTC is really probably the most important federal program in terms of the production of affordable housing, tax credit used by developers all over the country. It's been very successful over the last 40 years, had broad bipartisan support, and that was included in the legislation. So that was one big win. Other provisions were the mortgage interest reduction. That was something that was, remember, so much of this legislation is an extension of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And so provisions like the mortgage interest deduction, which were included in 2017, are made permanent in the One Big Beautiful Bill. And I think that that's pegged at $750,000 that homeowners can write off.
And I think you kind of answered it, but I was going to ask, do you kind of, is this bill a continuation of previous housing policies, or is it more of a shift in a whole new direction?
Yeah, that's actually, it's a great question. It is really primarily a continuation of existing housing policies. I mean, if I had to describe this bill in one sentence, I would say that it is an extension of the 2017 tax reform law. But one of the real important things, and this is a valuable distinction, so many tax provisions, because of congressional rules, have to expire after a certain number of years. What this particular piece of legislation did was take a lot of the 2017 cuts and make them permanent so that we are not having to extend them again in 5 years or 10 years. So, mortgage interest deduction being a really good example of that. And there are new things in this bill, and some of them have generated headlines like no tax on tips, a few other things that the president campaigned on in 2024. But primarily, it is an extension of current policy because without it, there would have been so many of the provisions of the 2017 law were set to expire at the end of 2025. And so we really were facing a pretty big tax hike, both corporate and individual, next year, had this legislation not passed.
Thank you for explaining that. This bill does have several affordability measures. How effective do you think that these will be in addressing, the inventory issue and the housing cost burdens, both now and in the future?
And I wish I could say that this is going to be this magic elixir that is going to overnight add to housing supply and make home ownership more affordable. I think they're all meaningful and significant, and I'm glad that they passed. But I also am cognizant of the fact that, we talk for a moment about the low-income housing tax credit. It will be years before we see a ramp up in production. Look, I wish I could tell you that LIHTC is going to, magically lead to an instant increase in housing supply, but in reality, it takes years to bring new housing units online, and it's going to be some time before we really see the effects of this. The same goes for the mortgage interest provisions. Look, I think there are two primary issues that are impacting the housing markets. One is the chronic undersupply. We have been not building enough housing in America since the great financial crisis of 2008. And we're not going to address that overnight, but some of the provisions in this bill are going to be meaningful in that. The other main driver is interest rates, and they are coming down. They're not coming down as quickly as all of us, whether you're lenders or home buyers or home sellers, would like to see. The mortgage interest deduction, and I should also mention a very key provision allowing a tax deduction for mortgage insurance as well. These are going to have a meaningful impact in terms of allowing people to afford a mortgage. So there's something lenders should be aware of.
And that leads me into, you know, we have a lot of originators that listen to this podcast. You said it earlier, the bill, it's a big bill. There's a lot of pieces to it. There's a lot of moving parts. I think a lot of companies are still kind of going through it. Mm-hmm. What are the specific parts of the bill that originators should really be paying attention to?
Yeah, I think originators should be focused on primarily two things. The mortgage interest deduction, which, as I mentioned, becomes permanent here. Congress years ago allowed for the tax deduction for mortgage insurance. And that is a provision that did lapse several years ago. It is now back. It is income targeted. It applies to both private mortgage insurance on Fannie and Freddie loans, but also on government programs like FHA. Another meaningful housing provision that borrowers should be aware of, and lenders should be certainly notifying borrowers, because it's going to allow them to, you know, potentially pencil out a mortgage that might not have otherwise penciled out.
For sure. And I mean, thinking as a buyer, I'm not a buyer today, but just knowing that there's been so many, you know, tax adjustments and all the things that go into this bill, I mean, which are there other aspects in the bill that home buyers should be really focused on or excited about?
Those are the main ones. But look, there are other sort of global provisions that impact this. One that immediately comes to mind is the state and local tax deduction, and this was a key sticking point during the negotiations over the One Big Beautiful Bill. But in the end, Republicans from some high-cost states, primarily New York and California, succeeded in quadrupling the SALT deduction from $10,000 to $40,000, which is very significant. It's capped out at $500,000, or I should say it's up to $500,000, and then it phases out between $500,000 and $6,000. Primarily for certain high-cost states like New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, California, this is going to be meaningful for home buyers and people who might have been taking the standard deduction over the last 2 years, could be enticed to itemize their taxes now that they can deduct more of their state and local taxes. And that's the other big global provision that is important to note in this legislation is the 2017 law more or less doubled the standard deduction to the point where probably 90% of taxpayers don't itemize anymore. That has now been made permanent. So that's another very significant provision in this law.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot. And I mean, I think, you know, it's going to be exciting as people start digging through it and hopefully finding more opportunities to get into homes and help with that affordability. Okay, so while I've got you here, I have to ask a little bit about just policy and housing because you've been around around it in NDC. And if I've got you, I might as well ask if you're okay with it. You know, you've been able to work alongside FHA Director, you know, Bill Pulte, and then the HUD Secretary, Scott Turner. How was that experience?
I have to tell you, both men have just been, I think, a breath of fresh air and also a jolt into the two agencies that they have been tasked with leading. I mean, I'll start with Scott Turner, who I was a former colleague of mine during the first Trump administration. He led the Opportunity Zone initiative. And by the way, I failed to mention it during our discussion about the One Big Beautiful Bill, but op zones are also made permanent in the legislation, which was Secretary Turner's highest priority. And so we're going to be able to designate op zones on an ongoing basis. Turner, he's a former NFL player. He is high energy. And I have to tell you, having worked at HUD, on two occasions, it's an agency that needs strong leadership, and someone who is out there and really promoting, what the agency is doing. He has been, on the road a ton, really, I would say making a lot of policy decisions very quickly. So he's a get things done kind of guy. And actually, I could say something very similar for Bill Pulte. He does not come from the usual Washington policy pedigree, but he comes from a storied home building family. I think housing is just very much in his veins. FHFA is an agency that I felt over the last several years had become politicized. They had taken their eye off the ball in terms of regulating Fannie and Freddie and were instead agents of social policy change. And I think that Pulte is in there very aggressively now, monitoring Fannie and Freddie, talking openly about a potential exit from conservatorship at some point over his tenure. He's not a traditional regulator, but frankly, that's really what I like about him. He's in there getting things done.
Yeah, that's really cool to hear. And you know, talking about GSE reform, because that's also very hot topic right now. I mean, what are the prospects for GSE reform?
So I've always been bullish on it, Hannah, and here's why. Because I felt that it's the unfinished business of the first Trump administration. It is something that in the first Trump term, then FHFA Director Mark Calabria and the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, they wanted to get here. Why didn't they get there? Because the COVID pandemic hit in 2020 and refocused all of the government in responding to this terrible event. But right up until noon on January 20th, 2021, I know Calabria in particular was pushing to get the GSEs out. I don't think the Trump administration, having been granted another 4 years, is going to let 4 years go by without addressing this issue. I mean, the companies have been in conservatorship now for almost 17 years, which if you had told me in 2008 that I'd be getting asked this question in 2025, I wouldn't have believed it. I think a lot has to happen to prepare the market for that, to prepare Fannie and Freddie. They need to continue to raise capital. There are just a lot of questions that need to be answered. And while I do think it is a priority for the Trump administration, I don't think it's a 2025 priority. I think that if you are Secretary Bessent, you've been focused on the tax negotiations for the first 6 months of the year. You have tariffs that have been dominating the headline. There's a lot that is going on. And Bessent has been clear he wants to get to this question, but it's a somewhat further down the road proposition. So so I don't think it'll happen this year, but I think there's going to be a lot more discussion about it come 2026.
So not this year, but this administration.
I think so. I wouldn't. I'm not giving it a 100%, but I would give it a solid 70%.
Pretty good percentage right there. You know, looking at just housing, the housing industry in general, what's being done at the agency level to address the just the housing industry, just through, you know, HUD, FHA, Ginnie Mae, all of it.
Yeah, there's been a focus on deregulation, which, and a lot of it, and this is what I alluded to with both Turner and Pulte, they're doing a wholesale review of some of the actions that have happened over the last few years, some of the green initiatives that have stymied production. That's the focus, because in a Republican administration, they're not going to throw money at the problem. So there isn't more money coming for HUD. It's how do we better utilize those dollars? How do we let the private sector address these issues? Secretary Turner, very fond of discussing public-private partnerships. Opportunity zones are the ultimate public-private partnership. So I would say that that's primarily how this, how HUD and FHFA are addressing these issues right now.
So Lynn, you recently launched Breakaway, which, you know, brings your decades of experience from both the private and public sectors to found a government affairs firm with a focus on housing policy and advocacy. Tell me about it. Where did you come up with the name? What are you doing? How's it going?
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that. It's a very new venture. I just launched Breakaway about 3 months ago. It's been a very thrilling 3 months. You know, when I left the Trump administration, I recognized that there really was insufficient government affairs, thought leadership and advocacy on housing. There seemed to be our government affairs practices on pretty much every other issue under the sun, but not when it came to housing. And so that's what I have focused on for the last 4 or 5 years. And then back in May, I launched Breakaway, and I am a cycling fanatic. When I'm not working or with my family, I am out on my bike, and big fan of the Tour de France and the Breakaway. Everyone knows about the Peloton. The Peloton is the, you know, 150 riders, and they're all, you know, 2 inches apart. But the Breakaway, they're the group of riders who are actually leading the race. And they got there by making strategic moves and hard work. And I thought that that was really the perfect metaphor for what I'm trying to do with my clients every day and have their issues stand out from the herd. So that's Breakaway.
That's awesome. Have you been to the Tour of France?
I have not. It is on my bucket list. The problem with the timing of the Tour de France is that it is during the month of July, which happens to be pretty much the busiest month in Washington. So it's very hard to get away, but someday.
That's awesome. You've described housing as a kitchen table issue, which, first of all, I just love that you call it a kitchen table issue. But from your seat in DC, I mean, what's really giving you hope about where housing policy is headed for the next couple of years?
What's giving me hope is that it really is becoming a bipartisan issue. And the strongest evidence of that is the legislation that the Banking Committee is taking up. That is a compilation of almost 30 separate legislative proposals, almost all of them bipartisan, Democrat and Republican senators coming together to address affordability, supply issue, consumer protection. I've never seen a package quite like this. And it is coming from Tim Scott, a Republican who ran for president, and Elizabeth Warren, who probably needs no introduction to the mortgage industry. And if the two of them can come together on a package of housing bills like this, that gives me hope.
That's awesome. That is really great. And I can't let you leave without asking our signature question. We're on the Lending Forward podcast. So, how do you or Breakaway plan to lend it forward for the rest of the year or, looking forward to 2026, 2027?
Oh, I love that question, Hannah. I just mentioned the legislative effort that is underway, and I just really want to keep the foot on the gas, whether it's on this Scott Warren bill or on GSE reform. I want to try to bring these issues across the finish line as much as possible over the next year or so.
I love it. Well, Lynn, I couldn't thank you enough for coming on the Lean Forward podcast and breaking down the bill and giving us some insider info just on policy and overall your experience in DC. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me, Hannah.
Thanks again for tuning into today's episode of the Lending Forward podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our channel, follow us on Instagram at Lending Forward, on YouTube and LinkedIn. Catch us every other Thursday with a brand new episode and go lend something forward today. Atlantic Bay Mortgage Group, LLC, NMLS number 72043, NMLSconsumerAccess.org is an equal opportunity lender and employer. Located at 600 Lynn Haven Parkway, Suite 100, Virginia Beach, Virginia 23452.